my agent had told me, you have a powerful story. And it's one thing for somebody to tell you that, but then for you to know it. And sometimes you can't know a thing until somebody tells you.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Marita Golden, author of the novel A Woman's Place, first published in 1986, a time when major publishers only seemed to take interest in Black voices during waves of racial reckoning and cultural backlash.
Because we have a long tradition of many of the most important books that Black writers have written being published by small Black presses or being self-published. So I want to get away from this idea that the white publishing industry, in its largesse, has published always the most significant work that we've done.
As the author of six novels, memoirs, and nonfiction works, and the co-founder of the Hurston Wright Foundation, Golden has dedicated her life not only to writing, but to mentoring Black writers from all over the world as they work to get their stories out. She explains the ruthlessness she had in writing her memoir based on what she was living through, why a woman's place must be carved from her own soul, and the charge for the next generation of young Black people to carry on. Marita shares her wisdom when Black and Published continues. All right, so Miss Marita, my first question is always, when did you know that you were a writer?
Well, I think I knew from a very early age, writing and imagining and reading was something I loved to do. It was my safe space. It was a place where I found enormous peace of mind and happiness. And this is from a pretty early age. And then my mother and my father did a lot to encourage my writing gift, my writing inclination. So I think that instinctively I knew I was a writer from a very young age. And once I was in college, I was really ready to formally claim that designation.
And so in formally claiming the designation in college, once you came out, what was your decision for your career once you realized, okay, this is what I'm going to claim over my life? I know you worked in publishing and did some freelancing, yes?
I went to the journalism school, graduate school of journalism at Columbia. And there I got a lot of good training in reporting and interviewing and writing. And the skills that I got there actually were a great source for the writing that I would do in the future, because I went from being a freelance journalist to really wanting to write fiction as well. There came a point when I wanted to write stories that only I could write, stories that weren't embedded in reality or fact. And so after a couple of years of freelance writing, I took a writing workshop at the New School in fiction and began writing fiction and learning how to be a fiction writer.
But your first book was your memoir, right?
Exactly.
So how did that work?
How it worked was that I was writing this semi-autobiographical coming-of-age novel, and I had married a Nigerian and gone to Nigeria to live with him, and spent 4 years there with him before the marriage dissolved. And one summer I came home, and the editor of Essence at that time, I said, you know, I'm looking for an agent. do you know anybody? So she recommended me to a young white woman named Carol Mann, who was just starting out. And actually, Carol and I, she's been my agent for 42 years, the only agent I've ever had. And she looked at the novel that I was writing and said, oh, this is interesting. This is good. You can write. But why aren't you writing about the experience of being in Nigeria and, you know, being this Black woman who came of age in the 60s and is a feminist in a patriarchal society? And she pointed out all the elements that made my life a really compelling story at that time. And I was like many young writers at that point in my life, knowing what a really good story was hard. You know, you can be in the, a good story could mug you and you wouldn't say, oh, that's a good story. So I said, well, okay, but I want to write this novel. So I went back to Nigeria and about a year later, the marriage began falling apart. And that was when I began to see that I had lived a really interesting, compelling experience. And I often tell the people that I work with in my classes that you know you're a writer when in the midst of your marriage falling apart and you're planning an escape, a way to escape a country with your child, you are also interviewing family members of the family that you're going to leave for information for the book that you plan to write once you get back to the States. So you're working on two levels of consciousness, one depression and sadness and crying, the other, oh, I got to get this material so I could use it in the book. And that's when you know, when you're that ruthless, you know that you're a writer.
So when you asked the editor of Essence, was that Susan L. Taylor that you asked about a literary?
No, that was actually Marsha Gillespie.
So back to the memoir and you being ruthless, interviewing members of the family, you're getting ready to leave. I didn't forget about that part. We were going to get back about what was happening as you're getting ready to make this grand escape. What was the mindset in knowing that you had this great story, but we're getting ready to upend your life and tell it anyway?
It was oddly empowering. I think creativity, whether it's painting or music or writing, can empower us, can give us the food, the spiritual, the literal food we need to survive times like that. And so that while I had made peace with the fact that this marriage had to end, it was still very traumatic that it had to end this way, that I felt I had to literally take my son and escape, that it wasn't the kind of reasonable conclusion to the marriage that I had wished. So I was on, as I said, two tracks. But what buoyed me, what gave me was this idea of this story that I held on to and that was a source of power, even in the midst of crisis, because my agent had told me that she wasn't my agent at that point, but she was going to be. She had told me, you have a powerful story. And it's one thing for somebody to tell you that, but then for you to know it. And sometimes you can't know a thing until somebody tells you.
And you had a powerful story, but then you also had your own coming of age story that you were still holding on to as well. So once you had published Migrations of the Heart, did that free you up to reinvest into what became A Woman's Place?
Yeah, because I think some of the seeds of A Woman's Place were embedded in that initial novel that I was working on. The novel was something that I was working on while I was living in Nigeria. And I would get up early in the morning. I had a little room that was my study. And so the writing had kept me balanced and empowered while I was living in Nigeria and grappling with enormous cultural contradictions and sort of the dissolution of the ways in which I had romanticized the continent. It was always the writing. It was always that place I could go that affirmed me and centered me. And I could do something every day that was, I could try to create a beautiful, clear sentence. And sometimes that's all you need to do. I mean, a couple of, maybe a year ago, I was reading Toni Morrison's, one of her many collections of essays. And she said that she wrote pretty much every day or, you know, regularly. And it was absolutely astonishing to me that she could write the novels she wrote. And then she wrote all these essays that showed this mind of a scholar and thinker that was literally on fire. But in the documentary about her life that was issued about 6 months before she died, there's this beautiful scene where she's outside her house and she's looking at the water. She talks about, you know, writing every day. And I think that it hit me then that it was a life source. You know, and she's not necessarily talking about writing for publication or writing in response to a contract, just writing. Mm-hmm. So throughout my life, writing in a variety of forms has been very important. And in fact, I'm working on I teach a lot of workshops on memoir. And I think that I agree with Susan Cheever, the writer who said that memoir is the novel of the 21st century for a lot of reasons. And I know without having written as many memoirs or combinations of those, I don't know that I would even understand my life. Because it gives you this way into your past and a way into your present that is really quite transformative. So to sit down and write a quote memoir at the age of 28, yikes, you know, because that was in a period when we thought of memoir, okay, it's dead white men, dead famous white men. And I was part of a group of women who were saying, no, you know, you can write about the passages of your life, the transformations of your life. You can write about trauma and give that depth. And that can be as compelling and as significant as being a president.
So I know Migrations of the Heart came out in 83, and then the novel A Woman's Place came out in 86. And I know Beloved came out in 86, and I think that was the last year Toni Morrison worked in publishing, or what did she leave after Sula? Can't recall. But I ask all that to ask.
I think she left after the Black Book.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I asked all that to get to this is, what was the publishing landscape like when you entered into it in those early 80s? Because as I've done this podcast and I've talked to writers across generations, most point to two moments: when Toni Morrison entered the publishing industry and when Terry McMillan started writing books. That's when we begin to see waves of, you know, Black writers being published, their stories being told, and then, you know, Black being in vogue. Before then, it was just like not a thing anymore.
Well, the uprisings of the mid 60s, in response to the assassination of Martin Luther King and the continuing systemic racism and police brutality in many communities around the country, had pretty much the same impact then as the murder of George Floyd did recently. And the cultural world responded in a major way. I mean, Arthur Mitchell started the Dance Theater of Harlem, and Eldridge Cleaver, the books by and about Black people, Maya Angelou. So there was this, even before Toni Morrison became an editor, there was a flowering of Black literature in response to the societal changes that we were forcing. I mean, because I think Maya Angelou's book was published, her first book was published in 65. Now, my first editor was a woman named Marie Brown, who was one of the very first if not the first, you know, Black editor at a major company. And she was with Doubleday. And Marie Brown single-handedly midwifed two or three generations of Black writers. Not all Black women, but a lot of Black women writers. So we owe an enormous debt to her, both as a editor and an agent. And so you had this trend that, you know, there in the Harlem Renaissance, and then you had a long period where it was just certain Black male writers, James Baldwin, Richard Wright, you know, certain men dominated the cultural space. And then in the 60s, the thing that was so beautiful about that was you had a flowering of Black female voices and Black male voices, Rosa Guy, Alice Childress. It was just absolutely amazing. But the problem continued to be, as it is now, is getting Black editors. Hmm. The publishing industry is very white, was very white then, is still very white. And to talk about, for example, yes, Toni Morrison, as an editor, did have a major impact. But there were people in the industry who preceded her, mm-hmm. who had okay. done similar work. And so she specifically knew what she wanted to do. She wanted to not just make a difference, but to bring out these voices that had been really marginalized. Now, when Terry McMillan was published, I think, I forget what year it was, her first book, Mama, and then
89?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. You had this amazing moment. I forget what year it was, but Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, and
Terry McMillan.
Terry were on the bestseller list at the same moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Temple of My Familiar, Waiting to Exhale, and I forget the Morrison book. But we'd never seen anything like that. Haven't seen anything like that since. That was a very unique cultural moment. And so I think that rather than saying, you know, that it's about one person, it's about a series of people, sung and unsung, known and unknown, who have kept creating opportunities for the mainstream publishing industry to publish Black writers. Because we have a long tradition of many of the most important books that Black writers have written being published by small Black presses or being self-published. For example, J.A. Rogers is a self-made Jamaican historian who in the 20s and 30s wrote a whole series of books about Africa's gift to America, about all the things that Black people had done in the world. I think he wrote about 5 or 6 books. Those books were not published by white publishers, but those books were on my father's bookshelf and handed down to me. So I want to get away from this idea that the white publishing industry, in its largesse, has published always the most significant work that we've done. I mean, Black Classic Press, Paul Coates published really significant work by Black thinkers and Black writers. So I look at the whole picture, and we give the white publishing industry, of course, you know, because it dominates and it gives the award and has a prestige. I think it's really important to understand and acknowledge that Black publishers have been there for a long time when white publishers you couldn't even get in the door. And it's just a shame that we're in 2022, in the 21st century, and for the first time in the history of the publishing industry, we have two Black women there's a Black woman, I can't remember her name, who's ahead at Simon & Schuster. She's the big boss over at Simon & Schuster. She makes all the decisions at Simon & Schuster. First time ever. And when you consider what Black writers have done for the publishing industry, the amount of money we've made, the amount of cultural legitimacy we have given to the culture, for this to be the first time in history that a Black person has been the big boss at a major company. And then I think there's a sister, she was just written up in the Times.
Lisa Lucas of Pantheon.
Yeah. So I'm not taking off my hat and giving the white publishing industry all this credit.
No, I asked that question only because on this podcast, as a self-published author who then started her own imprint, I do recognize the importance of, you know, you get our stories out by any means necessary, hook or crook.
Exactly.
And I'm from Chicago, which is the home of Third World Press, which is
exactly
major
Broadside.
Broadside,
mm-hmm. Dudley Randall.
So, but you, I just, looking at the publication dates of your works, I wanted to ask that. But then also you mentioned, you know, those moments in history from the turmoil of the late 60s through, you know, and now you see it again because of the reckoning with George Floyd. Simon & Schuster does have their first novel contest that's open to BIPOC writers with a $50,000 contract attached to it that came out of that uprising. And in all of this, you are re-releasing your first novel. How do you find the industry now, knowing all that you know, doing all that you've done and co-creating the Hurston Wright Foundation and mentoring other writers? You know, a lot of it has stayed the same, but have you seen some change in progress?
Well, I mean, certainly we now have a group of Black editors who are in strategic places within the industry to make change. And we have a whole group of Black people who over the last 30 years have gained experience in the mainstream publishing industry, no matter how long they were there. They were there a year, they were 5 years, whatever. So we have a huge talent pool of people that we haven't had before. But the industry has a long way to go in terms of solidifying. I want to see another Black person heading a publishing company. I want to see another person of color heading some more imprints. Because when you look at the ways in which the culture of people of color in this country is so dominant and so influential, for there to be this paucity of people of color in the publishing industry, it's scandalous. So yes, I will give them credit and say that there's still a lot more to be done.
Yes. And in all of that, in things being cyclical, I find that here we are with the re-release of A Woman's Place. So I would like you to read a portion of it because I read it, it's first time reading it, and I have all the questions about it.
And just to say, I mean, that is because of a Black woman and a very progressive press. Dave Eggers Press, McSweeney, is re-releasing the book, A Woman's Place, under the imprint of the diaspora. And Erica Tal-Lazar, who ironically was a winner of the Hurston Wright Award when she was in college, went on to become a scholar, a writer. And then she finds herself working in publishing and in a position to advocate in a supportive environment for the republication of Paul Marshall's book, Praise Song for the Widow, my book, W.B. Du Bois, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's some beauty in that. There's real beautiful symmetry in that.
Black and Published family, it's time for the reading. A Woman's Place is a novel that centers the stories of three women, Faith, Crystal, and Serena, as they come of age in the mid to late 60s, navigating everything from college to marriage to having children, and their role in the worlds they've created for themselves. Here's Marita.
I'll read a section from two of the women, Faith and Crystal. Faith, Winthrop University. Mama said she liked the sound of the name. Said it made her think of fine china, tweed suits, and money in the bank. But I just looked at the pictures in the catalog they sent and wondered why I was supposed to want everything I saw. Because that's how Mama made it sound. Like coming here wasn't my first chance, but my last one too. But nothing seems real. Not the teachers, not the students, and sometimes even me. If there was something here for me to believe in, I wouldn't be flunking out. I remember the first time I went into Hawthorne Hall to take Western Civilization. I caught my breath when I walked in through the door. And all these different smells and sensations hit me all at once. The ceiling was real high, and there was a chandelier hanging over a white marble sculpture of some nymphs. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and even though there was sunshine coming through the windows, there seemed to be more shadows than light. All along the walls were portraits of these old men wearing fancy clothes and whiskers, and the expressions I've seen on a lot of pictures of real rich people. Like they were surprised by how much they had, and surprised too that they didn't have even more. Those are the men who founded the school, and I could tell they liked what they saw when they looked at what they left behind. Crystal, there's a special language they use for us here, one laden with as much potential for treachery as salvation. Affirmative action, culturally deprived, the words chill me. And I suspect them most because I had no hand in shaping them. And they were handed to us to wear like labels that feel oddly like chains. There are days when the campus strikes me as some alien territory to which I'm drawn even as it repulses me. We each measure and choose our steps. Faith hugs the sidelines. Serena charges boldly into the fray. And I stand somewhere in the midst of it all, committed, but not certain why. Even after 3 years here, I don't quite know how to share this with my father. It was he, after all, who urged or rather decided that this was where I should go to college. It was he who told me that Winthrop was the promised land.
Thank you. So reading the novel, aside from maybe a few references to Vietnam and some of the cultural things that were happening at the time, it read very contemporary, like this could be happening yesterday, today.
Need I say more?
Yes. So did you know in 86 that it would hold so well 35, almost 36 years later?
Well, I think that when I write, I'm trying to write a story that people will want to read in 30 years. And I think that as much as I think what you're referencing is the fact that the cultural and racial and political environment in so many white institutions is as hostile today as it was to these young women. While that is daunting and depressing, I think what really makes any piece of fiction endure are the universal things, the tropes of friendship, the search for a place to be who you are. And that doesn't change. I thought that as I sat down writing this, that all these years later, you wouldn't have been able to tell me convincingly that we would be in the midst of another backlash, despite having had a Black president, which I would not have believed we were ever going to have a Black president. And I certainly wouldn't have believed that having a Black president would instigate the backlash that it did. So I had no idea. I predicted, I think that human beings are encoded to be optimists. And we write the world we live in. It's just that we find that in so many ways, the world we live in both changes and remains the same. I mean, and for example, to say a little bit more about that, my most recent book is a book called The Strong Black Woman, How a Myth Endangers the Physical and Mental Health of Black Women. And it's about Black women feeling that we always have to be strong. We have to be the anchors for our families. We wear masks to hide our real emotions for a lot of reasons. And those are concerns that have dogged us for generations. Absolutely. So like when Crystal says, you know, we've been labeled, each generation of Black people, Black women is wrestling with this monster that simply will not be tamed. And yes, when I was talking with Erica about, you know, the reissuing of the book, I said, oh my God. And I sat down and reread the book, and I said, oh my God, did I write this yesterday? And, you know.
Yeah, like one of the systemic things you allude to is early on, Crystal's talking to a friend, and I think she's talking to Faith and Serena, and she says, we spend so much time shouting, so much time talking, nobody ever wants to sit still and think about what they're doing to us and why we can't stop it. And I was just like, this could have been yesterday that we are talking about this. And so a lot of those moments ring really, really true as far as like the systemic oppression and finding a woman's place in it. But then also the patriarchal oppression also rings really true. Like there's some moments with the men in the book, like Rashid and Crystal's father, where I was just like having visceral WTF reactions. Like, what are we doing? What are we talking about? Do you find those struggles to still be as rough as it is now, as it was then?
You mean around Black men's attitudes and...
Black men's attitudes, interpersonal relationships between Black men and Black women, like that whole struggle against both patriarchy and white supremacy. So everybody's trying to find their place and rule over somebody.
Yeah. I think that one of the things I'll sort of back into an answer. One of the things that the positive things that have come out of the last 2 or 3 years has been the fact that our mental health as a people is something that we're now feeling that we can talk much more about. And when we look at the dynamics between Black men and women, so much of that is tied up in our mental health, our mental ill health. And I think two things that maybe, I think a lot of things that sort of, and I'm just going to say all the things that I think are contradictory. I think that you have among the younger generation of Black men, more of them who are willing to support Black women emotionally in ways that their fathers never could have imagined. I think that the women's movement, the womanist movement, Black women's increasing independence, there have been so many things that have happened that many of the women of my generation, we raised our sons to be much more supportive of women than the men that we were married to found it possible to be. So I think that there has been change. I think that there still, of course, needs to be more change. And so, for example, I just recently saw a very moving documentary called Aftershock about the maternal birth rate crisis in the Black community. And one of the most moving parts of it was to see these young Black men in their 30s, most of them mid-30s to late-30s, who had lost their partners to maternal death syndrome, and to see them in grief counseling, in support groups, to see them single-handedly raising the children that were left behind. I said, oh my God, so I think that there has been real change in this younger generation. Just as in the younger generation, there's a greater willingness to talk about mental health issues. So I think that the long answer that I'm giving is that yes, I think this new generation of Black people male and female, queer, whatever, is creating relationships that have the potential to be much more healthy. But I do think that there are still problems within the older generation in terms of those kinds of issues. And I think the job that the younger generation has is to pull the older generation into this new world. So they find themselves in a position where they have to be leading the family. But I think they're equipped to do it.
And I find it interesting that you say that and then talking about pulling in the younger generation, because the book ends with the youngest generation being Aisha's daughter, Tamika, coming to this realization of what it means to be a woman and what a woman's place is. Were you able to define it then when you were writing the book, or can you define it now?
Well, she's essentially saying that her place is a place that she has to carve out of her soul. Now she's going to carve it out of her soul in communication and communion with the women who have shaped her, her mother, her grandmother. And she's going to take a little bit from each of them. But the main thing she's going to do is listen to her soul. And each of those women in a different way has taught her how to do it. She watched her mother in a marriage that starts out quite patriarchal, quite stifling, chisel out a way to have a voice in the confines of that marriage. She's watched Serena, you know, go literally out into the world, all over the world, being part of political change and having a child and being unmarried. So she's seen all these different ways that you can be a woman. And from that, she's going to, and the fact that she says that she's going to trust herself is, I think, an inheritance of feminism, an inheritance of the legacy of womanism, an inheritance of the fact that I think that Black women are inherently feminist, feminist beyond class, feminist beyond background, feminist beyond education.
So with all that said, this book came out, and its initial release came out the year I was born. So coming to it today, it still rang very true. What do you want this new generation of us readers to get from A Woman's Place?
Well, first, I want the reader to get a really good story. This grew out of the fact, in part, that I lost my mother and my father when I was very young. My mother died when I was 21 and my father died when I was 23. So creating families through friendship became a really important thing for me. And I found friendship and sustenance and support in the friendship of a group of women. And that meant so much to me. But I think first I want them to get a good story. I want them to get a story that challenges them, provokes them, and enlarges them. That's the first thing, because I think stories are very, very powerful. We live and breathe by stories all day long. And then I want them to think about, you know, the different elements of the story. But first I want them to get to just be ushered into this story that's a world of that period. And just because they will be in imbibing and learning and taking in a lot just as they read and give themselves over to the story. So I want them to have a, I want them to just enjoy the story. And then let the story resonate and live in them. So that's what I would say.
Yes, ma'am. All right, I want to shift away from the book and do quick speed round in a little game before I let you go for the morning. What is your favorite book?
Well, my two favorites are War and Peace and Their Eyes Are Watching God.
Who is your favorite author?
My two favorite authors are Chekhov and Hurston.
Name a poet or poets who you think aren't well-read enough?
I would say someone like Robert Hayden, who is brilliant, but who tends to be read mostly by Black scholars, you know, people who write poetry, people who write about poetry. And I'll say also Sterling Brown. I loved his poetry rooted in Black folklore, Black voice, the blues. So I would say those two. I'd love to see, oh, and God, you know, when I think about Sterling Brown, what today's generation of writers and rappers and just everybody could learn from him. Yeah, Sterling Brown and Robert Hayden.
And then what's the difference between poetry and spoken word?
I think we have different definitions of the forms of artistry in both. I think we think of poetry in some ways as, quote, superior to spoken word, but I think spoken word has its own precision and its own exactitude that's very different. And the people who fully understand it get that.
So you've done a lot in your life of literature. You even say it in your introduction that, you know, writing is not just a career choice, but it's who you are, it's what you do. So if money were no option, where would you go, what would you do, and where would you live?
So I think if money were no object, I would live right where I am. And I take all the money that I have and do as much good with it in the world. And I'd be writing. And I just do this pretty much the same thing I'm doing now. I mean, I have a great life. I have one of those lives that I don't need to say if money were no object and blah, 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 because I am really living the life that I wanted to live. Now, when I designed it in my dreams, it didn't have the challenges. It had only the good thing, but I'm living a great life.
Hashtag goals. All right. So my little game is called Rewriting the Classics. We'll see how far we get. What's the one book you wished you would have written?
You mean a book by another writer that I wished I'd written?
Mm-hmm.
None.
Is there a book where you would like to change the ending? And if so, how would you do it?
In Their Eyes Are Watching God, I would like to have heard Janie speak during her trial. Mm. You know, a lot of people, there's so much has been written about that book, and sort of the major critique is that the book is about Janie finding her voice, finding herself. And yet at the pivotal moment in the book, which is when she's on trial and she can make her case, she's silent. Mm. And there are some legalistic reasons for why she may have done that. That is, once you're on the stand, it's not just that your lawyer can question you, but the prosecutor can question you.
Yep.
But at the same time, that would have provided even more drama. And it doesn't mean that Janie would not have prevailed. So, yeah, I would have found a way to add her voice.
I like that. I got to go back and reread Their Eyes Are Watching God now just to get to that scene again.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so my final question for Read, Write, and Classics is, name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught. Anybody, any
child. You're going to get me in trouble.
Everybody says that, which means I have to change the game for this season, but I haven't done it yet. I put no stipulations on it.
Probably To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, I think that it's a book that is sort of easy to get into, you know, a discussion of the themes. And I'd like to see it ushered off the stage so that room can be made for a more bracing discussion of those same themes.
It could easily be switched out with the book that's always being banned, The Hate U Give.
Mm-hmm.
About the same age.
Mm-hmm.
Group.
Mm-hmm. 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 So I think that's what I, you know, and it's one of those congratulatory books, you know, oh, America, oh yeah, we're racist, but you know, not really, you know. So I think that's the one I would say.
Yeah, okay. And so my final question for our interview today is, when you are among the ancestors and no longer here, what would you like someone to write about the words and work that you left behind?
She gave us everything she had.
Thank you, Miss Marita. That was beautiful.
Big thank you to Marita Golden for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Marita's novel, A Woman's Place, re-released from McSweeney's. And if you're not following Marita, follow her on the socials. She's at Marita Golden on Twitter. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Marita about the power of books and the importance of Black editors. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments.
I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Dawn Turner, author of the memoir, Three Girls from Bronzeville.
I didn't want this to be a story about one girl who did everything perfectly and the other two who didn't, because that would have been bullshit. And so I had to share some things that I'd never told anybody.
That's next week on Black and Published. Peace.